His TV show No Reservations is in its sixth season on the Travel Channel. In addition to being a TV star, he's also an author, a very good one at that. His latest book is called Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook It. Anthony Bourdain joins us now in studio. I'm very excited to meet you. Thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
How do you clean up the water when it is fouled in that specific way?
Well, you know, fast food is good food.
When it's not one big spill, it's a gazillion patches of oil going in every direction, growing and changing every day.
So you get this incredible variety of highly specialized, super cheap, super fast, delicious food.
Frankly, I'm at the point now where I don't want to hear from people anymore who are overwhelmed or mystified by what's going on in the Gulf. I can curl up with that feeling alone at night in my own head.
For some reason, we don't have that here, the way they do in much of Asia, and we should.
I'm at the point where I need to hear from people who are actively working to figure this stuff out.
I think it's a vicious cycle. I think also we come from a culture that, at least until around 20 years ago, I mean, people go to a lot of these places. I won't name the names. We know who they are. Fast food is good food.
Hey, what's happening? Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. Apologize for the long delay in getting things started back up. I have been living on island time for about a month now. You know, you take a vacation and you come back and sometimes you feel like you need a vacation from the vacation. So it's like that. I had an incredible time in Hawaii. I want to talk about that today, about the food, about the people, the culture, and some other things. Oh, and the beer. You ever get back from a trip to someplace like naturally magical, like an island or some sought-after resort area, or like France, right? You get back to a really naturally dreamy trip, something you know is not going to suck. You get back and people go, how was it? How do you think it was, man? It was awesome. Oh, no, it was horrible. Freaking sunshine every day, didn't have to work, watched incredible sunsets every night, ate all I wanted, snorkeled all the time. You know, water was like bathwater. Horrible. Just horrible. I'll never do it again. One thing that did stick with me on this trip was how delicate the ecosystem in the ocean is. And I knew this, but when you put your head down there, you see it. And I had just had, you know, Martin Reed from I Love Blue Sea on the last show, and it stuck with me. And spending as much time as I did with my head in the water for the first time in a few years, really, it brought it back to me. Especially when we think about what's going on in the Gulf right now. I can hardly think of what it would have been like for these fish, these beautiful fish, to be dealing with what's going on down there. Amazing, beautiful fish down there. They eat all day, delicate bites off the coral. They're in a world all of their own. And we come along and fill it with crude oil, and we kill them. And the shrimp industry is dying. The fishing industry in general in the Gulf is about to die. People who have devoted their lives to their businesses are going to lose them. Because we need gas. We need to drill down there. This isn't a discussion I want to have here, but I spent a good amount of time with my head underwater in my life in the ocean, swimming with fish large and small. I've spent hours upon hours diving, snorkeling, free diving. I can tell you this. A lot of us, we have no idea what's going on down there. And the fish have no idea what's going on up here either. And they could give a rat's ass. So, you know, we should leave them alone. Anyway, I want to thank you guys for your feedback, for your support and tweets on that bug video we ended the season with Don and I. I know it was probably a little too much to stomach, but I appreciate that you stuck with me on that. I now have an even greater appreciation for Andrew Zimmern and all that he does on Bizarre Foods every week. I swear, it wasn't a big deal. Eating those bugs, okay? They weren't the greatest things in the world. Texturally, they kind of sucked. They were challenging. And those are some of the more timid foods that he eats. On the bizarre scale, that's timid. I know there's no way I could possibly stomach a quarter of what that man stuffs in his mouth. But it was fun. I'm glad we did it. Gave me an excuse to feature new music from the Crystal Method. Hope you like that. Check out the new album, Divided by Night, on their website, thecrystalmethod.net. Great music, great stuff. And because I can't do this show without something in my big fat mouth, I'm going to go ahead and share this beer with you. I'm having this beer. I had one already. I had one of these I had on the show before, way back in season one. You know, when you visit Hawaii, you got to bring some local beer back. You got to try some local beer. Unfortunately, in Hawaii, for the most part, anyway, for me anyway, Hawaiian beer is just a big bowl of meh. You don't care about it. Kona Brewing, it's so big now. And I can't believe it. It's growing in popularity. It's got like an average B or A rating on Beer Advocate. I would not choose that beer over another craft beer if I had another choice. And I always have other choices. But people rave about them. There's nothing about that brewery that I feel outshines other craft beer. I think if you put it in a lineup with a bunch of bad beers, I'm definitely going to drink it. And I'm not saying it's bad beer. I'm just saying if I've got other choices, I'm taking them. Maui Brewing is a complete other story. I featured their Big Swell IPA on the show before. That's what I just had. And it's as big a West Coast IPA, wet hopped, as you could possibly get. The beer is malty. It's sweet. It's loaded with a front nose of hops. Very citrusy. Not too piney. And every single thing I ask for from this style, this West Coast IPA style, just fantastic. I had that one earlier. But right now, I'm enjoying another kick-ass beer that they make. Their coconut porter. And I can tell you this. Sometimes I can't tell the difference, if you don't tell me, between a porter and a stout. Because, you know, sometimes so stout will kick you in the nose pretty hard with roasted malt. You know it's a stout. But a lot of times, I can drink these porters or a stout, and I can't tell you why I take one over the other. Or tell you which was which. But what Maui Brewing does, they make this chocolate thunder of a drink, rich with flavor of toasted coconut. And it's a challenge to actually taste the coconut in this beer, but I figured out how to do it. You got to have a couple of these, okay? And you figure out how to figure out to get the coconut out of it. You take a sip, swallow it, and then you kind of close your nose off a little bit. You know, you close your nasal passage and carefully inhale with your mouth a tiny bit and at the same time slowly reopen your nasal passage. And I'm going to do that right now. Listen. Yep. Right there. That's where you taste it. It's there. It's fantastic. The beer is not overly roasty, but it's not buried in hops. It's got a little, you know, you can kind of, you know the hops are there, but it's sweet enough. And that little dusting of roasted coconut. Man, that's great. It's a special island flavor that you're not going to taste this in another beer. In fact, they collaborated with Stone on a beer. I can't remember what it was called. Maui Brewing's Coconut Porter was in that. Anyway, something to be proud of. I'm telling you, Maui Brewing has got, they got their shit together. And they became my favorite beer while I was in Hawaii. Actually became my favorite beer of May. You know, the interesting thing about Hawaii is that if you live in or around the beach and you're used to beach culture and you live like this, which most of us in Southern California are, especially those of us in Orange County, San Diego, if you go to Hawaii, it's not that much of a culture shock. Beach life is beach life. It's different than any other kind of city living. You've got an inordinate amount of whack jobs running around shouting biblical stuff, panhandling for money, playing their bullshit bad music on the street for pocket change. And then there are tons of unnaturally good-looking young people, sculpted bodies, big tits, walking around half-naked. The occasional whiff of a Dead Sea animal of some kind will kind of hit your nose. But usually they're just salty sea smells. There's no real way of explaining what that smells like and feels like other than to say you just got to come and experience it for yourself. People think Californians are nuts because we wear sandals about 12 months out of the year. But when you live in beach culture like this or you adopt it as part of your own lifestyle, you don't think it's that silly. So going to Hawaii was not a huge stretch for me. In fact, I'm wearing sandals. Those people are barefoot. They're walking around with no shoes. And we'd been back in Oahu. We'd been there in 2004. The only reason we chose to return to that island instead of going to another one is that I wanted to pay one more visit to Pearl Harbor and the Arizona Memorial. And more about that later. As Katrina says, it's a whole other Oprah. But if you're visiting Hawaii for the very first time, it's always suggested that you go to Oahu first because it's the most populated island. It's got the most to offer. You know, there's Pearl Harbor, Hanama Bay, which is the best snorkeling spot in all the world, the infamous North Shore, which provides some of the premier surfing, and Waikiki Beach, which is like, that's the best people-watching spot, I think, ever. The Japanese, they love visiting Waikiki because they can fly there cheaply, buy the shit out of the place. There's a high-fashion district there, and they can bring all that stuff back duty-free. So if they flew to Beverly Hills, not only would it cost them more to fly there, but they have to pay duty up the ass on everything. But Waikiki saves them money. So there's a lot of high-end clothing stores there, and they built it just for that. And there are a ton of people there. But my intention in going this time also was to pay close attention to the food. Just as we did before, we rented a condo for the week, had a nice kitchen, we cooked breakfast and dinner there every night, we ate lunch wherever we wanted. Hawaii, I think, you know, it's got really weird food culture. Because it's so strange. You know, on one hand, they've got indigenous ingredients that make up one side of their cuisine, and that's the stuff we would normally eat almost daily. The island has two things. They have a lot of two things, pork and seafood. They've got wild boar all over the island, and they've got a lot of fish swimming around out there. So they've got traditional dishes like kalua pork, which is like a pork shoulder seasoned with Hawaiian sea salt. It's either baked or barbecued over wood for a long time and a little bit of moisture, and then they shred it. It's more like a smoky pulled pork. Really good. Then there's traditional items like lomi salmon, which is diced tomatoes and salty salmon, kind of like a salsa, right? There's poke, which I've talked about before. It's cubed anything, really, but because poke means cubed. But it's usually fish marinated with shoyu, which is soy sauce for the rest of you round eyes. Seaweed, green onion, sesame seed, sesame oil. Sometimes I'll put some pepper in there. I ate so many different varieties of poke. It was ridiculous. Ahi poke, octopus poke, kimchi poke, razor clam poke. And you can get this stuff pretty much anywhere. You go to any store. Like they have like a Safeway. It's like the general supermarket. Go into the meat department. 18 different varieties of poke. Tofu poke. Cheap. I mean, I think ahi poke was like $8.99. Some cheap fish. Now, you buy it in a grocery store, you're not going to get quality fish. If you go to a higher-end store, you're going to pay a little more, but you're going to get better fish. Go to a restaurant, you're going to get probably the best sashimi on the island. But it's all uncooked, right? So you're definitely getting fresh fish. Sashimi, very healthy. There's poi, which, you know, people find it nasty. I don't think it's that bad. Lumi salad, which is like Hawaii's seaweed salad. Lots of pickles, kind of like an influence from Korean people who have lived there. It's a great cuisine there, a traditional cuisine. But then, you know, the island's got this psychotic side to it. Like, they're schizophrenic. You know, for one thing, spam is really huge there. And people wonder why. One of Hawaii's most famous dishes is spam musubi. And you know what this is? It's a take on a Japanese omusubi or onigiri. It's a block of sticky rice, which is, it's traditionally Hawaiian. The way Hawaiians make rice, it's a Hawaiian staple. My favorite preparation of rice, sticky rice. They just use a little bit more water, makes it glutinous and really sticky. You can eat it with your hands. So they make a block of that, a little slice of cooked spam they lay across the top. They wrap that with a piece of nori, which is dried seaweed for the rest of you ground ice. Didn't know what shoyu was. And then they make a sandwich out of it. So it's like a spam sandwich, but it tastes kind of like a piece of sushi. It's freaking great. I really like it, but it's undeniably weird because it would make more sense to put fish in there. Even tuna fish would make more sense. Any kind of fish. Filet of fish. Okay? But they use spam because that's what makes them feel like they're home. Hawaii loves spam. And I'm going to let my soul brother Andrew Zimmern tell you why Hawaii loves spam so much.
Spam is another one of those everyday foods that I just don't like. There's the salty taste, the mealy texture, but mostly it's the idea of canned meat. I'm okay with the oddest of foods when it's fresh from its source, but to me, spam means eating factory leftovers that have simply sat too long on a shelf. And I'm from Minnesota, the birthplace of spam. Back in 1937, Hormel Meats in Austin, Minnesota, came up with a product made from their leftover ham and pork shoulder. And spam turned out to be just the thing for getting meat to American soldiers out in the field. Wherever the GIs went, spam went too. And that included Hawaii, where Spam was a godsend during meat shortages caused by the war. By the time those shortages ended, Spam had become part of the food landscape.
You see, so Spam was a result of the military and the need that arose to provide them with canned meat that had a long shelf life. Now, we all know the history of Hawaii and the military, Pearl Harbor, World War II, the Pacific Fleet, Nimitz, the whole nine yards. So we can now understand the origins of Spam. But who the hell can explain Loco Moco? What drunken motherfucker invented this pile of leftovers? You want to know where my limits are? Right here. It's a pile of white, sticky rice that they top with like a ground beef patty, two fried eggs or just one fried egg, and then brown gravy. It's the one dish I think that should come with a heart defibrillator. If you think it sounds gross, Google it. Loco Moco. Okay? Take a look at that. It's disgusting. Some drunken bastard came home at 5, 6 in the morning, drank all night. He was famished and just invented this heart attack-inducing nightmare. It's the other half of Hawaiian cuisine. It's that kind of mixed up type of thing that makes Hawaii unique. I would rather eat the fish and pork, leave the rest of the stuff to the locals, and they're fine with that, I think. But when we were there the first time, I bought two cookbooks. One was this cookbook that accompanied some TV show. It's a series on cooking Hawaii, and it featured gourmet dishes from a lot of the high-end restaurants all over the islands, lots of seafood, fruit, pork, really intense flavors, great plating, top-notch food. That, I think, is traditional Hawaiian food. The other cookbook I bought was a compilation of family recipes from other people throughout all the islands. And that book was compiled by a handful of these housewives whose husbands were either on business or in the military and then decided to live there. And that book consisted of home cooking. Now, it had a few traditional recipes in it, but it also contained recipes that confused the shit out of me. Recipes with names like hot macadamia chicken dip with toast points, over-the-top spinach dip, nine-bean soup, spaghetti with clam sauce, spicy garlic eggplant and pork, curried pineapple mango chicken, Christmas salad supreme. And there are recipes in this book. Of course, it's an inside aisle book, right? So basically, you know, most of the stuff you get in the inside aisles. But I kept it because it represented that vacation, which I loved. And it's got tidbits about, you know, the islands and little factoids and stuff. But the recipes, nah, I'd just as soon cook from Family Circle magazine, you know? So, yeah, food-wise, Hawaii, very interesting place. If you love to eat Asian food, it's definitely the place to be. Tons of fresh fish, sashimi, huge-ass oysters, lots of pork, Korean pickles, stuff I eat all the time. Listen, if it comes from the ocean, I'll eat it. If it originated from Asia in any way, I'll eat that. Okay, so here's a shocker, and don't think this is going to become a habit now that we're in our fourth season, like suddenly I've become soft or something, but high fives to Rachel Ray.
Will you stop it? Are you out of your mind?
Yeah, that's right. Listen to this, man. She's on the Joy Behar show on CNN's Headline News, and this is the most fantastic conversation. Listen to this.
When I was a kid, we grew up, you know, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. We never had any money. No one had any money. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, we ate very nutritious meals.
There was less processed food in the world at large, period. So you were getting
we
higher
had a fruit
nutrition.
Store. There was a butcher. There was a
there
fish
was
store.
There was access. Yeah. Exactly. There was access.
And that has disappeared
correct.
In the country.
There are food deserts all over the country. We're trying to turn
isn't
that
it a,
tide
isn't
too.
It an economic thing? Isn't it a class thing? In poor neighborhoods, you're not going to have a Whole Foods.
Correct.
Where people can go and get
correct.
Good fruit and
that's
vegetable.
Why we're trying to start community gardening projects and gardening mm-hmm. projects in our public schools and to teach kids about nutrition at a very early age so they become the owners of their own food destiny. You know, and it not only makes them healthier, it keeps them more alert in school. You end up with brighter, more well-balanced graduates.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, KFC just introduced the double down. Have you seen this thing?
The double bypass, I
it
call
has
it.
The double bypass.
Yeah.
Two fried chicken fillets instead of bread.
And two bacon and two cheese and sauce.
Oh, that's the part that's bad, because the chicken is better than the bread, which is white flour, crappy bread, right?
I just don't see a need for it. It's like handing people a gun. I mean, I'm a person that thinks of all things in moderation. I've had a piece of KFC in my life. It was pretty tasty. Mm-hmm. I just think that whole mindset that you can have everything you want at all the time and at once is a very dangerous mentality when it comes to anything, including food.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, it's a shame that that kind of food is more inexpensive, though. You know, people who don't have money
can go
to KFC. They say feed a family of eight for $10 or whatever it is.
You know, this is why.
And it's done.
It's so many levels to this conversation. And that's part of what I try and do with the content on the show or in any, the magazines or books, is to show people easy, affordable, that's the key word, easy and affordable meal options.
It's hard to do.
They're not armed with that when they go into the grocery store. They don't even know where to look. You got to look high. You got to look low. You got to read unit price, not package price.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a multi-layered thing. We got to do, you know, more lobbying. We have to have more conversation about the quality of food we give our kids in school and out of school. And we have to teach people what our grandparents knew how to do.
Yeah, they did know how to
stretch
do it.
A buck.
Well,
take a couple
we come
items.
From Italian families. Mm-hmm. I mean, they knew how to cook. And they knew how to put, they always use fresh food in my family. I don't think I ever had anything processed.
Well, and I
as
think we have to get this education back into the public school system as part of the overall education of our young people. It really does do so much for a child's self-esteem, other than just their health and their mental well-being. Being able to provide for themselves the rest of their lives on a couple of bucks, knowing they're not going to starve, that they can provide for themselves, gives them a real center of gravity.
Yes.
When times are tight and money's tight, they're not as scared as the next guy because they know they're not going to starve.
I mean, that is awesome. And she looks great. Listen, I got to add, she looks, I don't know if she's had a little makeover or something. Anyway, I want to show you something. I'm going to give you a quick recipe for one of my most delicious appetizers that I make. Easy for you to make. It's traditional Hawaiian poke. You can use anything as the main ingredient for this, okay? Poke means cubed. It doesn't necessarily mean fish, okay? Traditionally, it's sashimi-grade fish cut into cubes. You can use tofu, vegetables, anything you like, okay? But if you decide on a fish, you need to make sure it's sashimi-grade because this isn't a cooked dish. You're going to be eating this raw, all right? So here's what you need to make poke. Here's how you prepare it. You're going to need 1 pound of fresh ahi, yellowtail, cooked octopus, clams, whatever you choose, and then cut this into half-inch cubes. Again, you can use anything you want here, as long as it's okay to eat it raw. And if it's like, you know, octopus, you want to cook it first. In a medium-sized bowl, mix together a half a cup of soy sauce, 1 tablespoon of sesame oil, and 1/4 cup of chopped green onions. Toss the cube fish into that bowl. Gently roll it a few times to get everything with the marinade. Okay? Don't want to stir it. You want to roll it. Be gentle. You'll break the fish up. And then top that poke with 1 teaspoon of toasted sesame seeds and 1 teaspoon of dried red pepper flakes, chili paste, or freshly minced serrano pepper. Now, that's optional. If you don't want it hot, don't add the pepper. I like it that way. It gives it a little pop. Again, listen, when you mix it, don't mix it wildly. It's not like soup or anything. Last thing you want to do is manhandle this stuff. You'll tear the fish up. You just kind of roll it. Be gentle. Make sure everything's covered. Cover it. Put it in the refrigerator. Marinate it for at least 1 hour. Then it's ready to serve. And I'll tell you something. One of the coolest things to do with poke, it's the now infamous poke taco. I take a gyoza wrapper, which is nothing more than a wonton wrapper, okay? It's round instead of square. I fry these in peanut oil, but I fold them into half to make a shape of a taco. Then I mash some avocado. I season it with some sea salt. Put a little lemon juice in there. Squeeze a lemon juice and maybe a little tiny bit of olive oil. Whip it up, almost like guacamole. All right, I put a little bit of that in the bottom of the shell. I cover that with 2 tablespoons of poke. I lay a few daikon radish sprouts across the top. Drizzle some wasabi mayonnaise on top of that. And then I put a little sliver of jalapeno. It's one of the coolest, best-tasting appetizers I make for parties. I make a lot of appetizers, believe me. Try this sometime. In fact, you know what? I got a diagram that I'm making for the show here. I'm going to show you how to put these together. I'm going to post this on the website. Click on it. It's a big, giant graphic. Go to mylifeisafoodie.com. Inside the post for the show, I'll put it up there. It'll just show you how to put it together. Hey, you know, this is kind of tough. Anthony Bourdain, I love the dude, all right? But man, sometimes he gets a little bullish. I think he went a little far here. His book, Medium Raw, okay, it was just released this week. I have it, and as soon as I get caught up in everything else, I'm going to read it thoroughly and give you my own thoughts. I usually bust through one of his books in a matter of a couple of days. If I don't have anything going on a weekend, I can bust through it. It's a great read. He always writes really well. But based on what he said recently in the press and something I read recently in the Village Voice, I think he crossed the line into bully territory. apparently, for whatever reason, and I haven't read about the whole, I don't know the whole story here. 2 years ago, Bourdain skewered Alan Richman, who writes for GQ magazine. He's their food writer. And he's received a dozen James Beard Awards for his work. Okay, so he's not really a hack. He nominated Richman for the Douchebag of the Year Award back in 2008. Now, I don't know why he's picking on Richman. Like I said, he just doesn't like him for whatever reason. And it turns out Richman, who thinks Bourdain's a hack, a bad writer, and a bully, decides to strike back at him. So he goes to Layal, where Bourdain used to work, of course. You know, he has dinner there. And then he writes this scathing review of the restaurant. He says it's way overpriced. He said the food sucks. It's a shame that people have to, you know, pay the amount of money they do for food. They're having the wool pulled over their eyes. The place is only famous because Bourdain once worked there. And in doing this, he blasted Bourdain by saying he was a bad chef to begin with. Okay, so Bourdain dedicates an entire chapter of his new book, Medium Raw to Richman, and titles it, Alan Richman is a Douchebag. He calls Richman's review of Layal a vicious sucker punch to my old girlfriend from junior high, who I haven't seen in years. He spends an entire chapter busting Richman's balls. And at the end of the whole thing, he calls Alan Richman, and I'm quoting here, all right, so don't shoot the messenger, calls him a cunt. Now, I read that part of the, because I knew I was going to mention this, I read that part of the chapter. And he prefaces it by saying, well, in England and Britain, they drop the C word. We call it the C word, of course. He dropped it. You know, they drop it all the time. And I've hung out in circles with British guys, and they use the C word liberally. But I'm going to tell you something. I don't know if he's just trying to sell books, get people interested in his ability to stage war with people, food writers. But to use the C word in print, that's rough. To even say it is rough. And I do tend to think that a lot of the time, Bourdain says this stuff, you know, because it's shtick. He tends to jump the fence a lot. He says one thing, means another. Or he'll say one thing, mean it, and then change his mind. So, you know, you never know. In 2 months, highly unlikely, but in 2 months, he might end up miraculously being good friends with Richman. And then there's always going to be that one page at the end of that chapter where he called the guy a, you know, C word. Nope. Maybe he knows what he's doing. I don't know. Maybe I'm seeing it wrong. Although, I don't know, man. I've had that word float around in conversation quite a bit when I talk to these, you know, my friends who were British. And that doesn't make it okay. But they use that word differently. They don't use that word like we use it, obviously. So Richman says he wrote that review because he thought Bourdain shouldn't be allowed to get away with this onslaught of slurs and insults at everybody, not just him. And he felt the restaurant would probably be better than it was when Bourdain worked there because he didn't think Bourdain was a very good chef to begin with. As it turned out, it was worse than he expected. He called it dreadful. He said he went in, the expectations were low, and they underwhelmed him. And the fact is that they bank on Bourdain's fame everywhere you look. It's like, it's incredulous. 600 tables a night they turn. And he doesn't understand how they can be this crowded when the food is that bad. Now, I haven't eaten there, but it's at the top of my list. When I return to New York to see my sister, top of my list, I'm going to go there. I can only hope Richman's wrong, all right? But I love reading his pieces in GQ. It'd be a shame if he actually did a disservice to a reputable restaurant like this, because I don't like when people do that. Anyway, Bourdain's book, Medium Raw, is available now. It's always interesting to see just how far Bourdain's going to go with his opinions. He was on the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC. I kind of chopped that up on the intro, but I'm going to play the whole thing now. I want to play the whole interview, the real one. It's a pretty decent interview. Audio is courtesy of MSNBC.
That was Anthony Bourdain in Malaysia. His TV show, No Reservations, is in its sixth season on the Travel Channel. In addition to being a TV star, he is also an author, a very good one at that. His latest book is called Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook It. Anthony Bourdain joins us now in studio. I'm very excited to meet you. Thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Something you said in the book jumped out at me. You said this gave this very specific prescription. And you said that you think that America could benefit from Asian-style food courts. Why do you think that?
Well, you know, fast food is good food in much of Asia, Singapore and Malaysia, Hong Kong in particular.
you go to food courts that look much like the terrible food courts we have in our shopping malls, you know, central sort of shared tables, a lot of businesses around them, and instead of the usual suspects, they've got these sort of one cook, one dish specialty places, often third or fourth generation joints that, you know, there'll be the roast duck guy from China, there'll be someone doing fish head curry from India, a Malay style, a bakute or something like that. So you get this incredible variety of highly specialized, super cheap, super fast, delicious food, and it's probably even healthy, and all in a sort of a fast food, food court environment. And for some reason, we don't have that here or the way they do in much of Asia, and we should.
Do we not have that because in order to have cheap food, we have mass-produced food, and in order to have mass-produced food, you need to have these big chains?
I think it's a vicious cycle. I think also we come from a culture that at least until around 20 years ago, I mean, people go to a lot of these places. I won't name the names. We know who they are. They know the burger's not particularly good, but they know that it's the same burger they had last time in another city, in the other city, in the other city. They know they have that assurance that it's at least going to be the same, if not a very good one. And that means a lot to Americans, that it's reasonably safe as they see it, clean as they see it, and non-threatening, you know, yeah, in their comfort zone. And that's unfortunate.
I wonder if undermining the perception of safety and cleanliness is a big part of what's maybe starting to change about perceptions of the healthfulness of that kind of eating.
Well, I think people like Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser and the film Food Inc. have done a pretty good job of, you know, scaring the hell out of people. And they should be scared, both because there's stuff to be scared of and because it's, I think it's good for the country if we move away from that.
You are sort of famously unafraid of food. I've seen you eat a lot of things that are things that I would not want to eat. But you seem a little grossed out by hamburger.
I got to say, I mean, a hot dog, there's sort of implied consent there. You know, you take your chances. It's floating in the dirty water, and you have a pretty good expectation there might be dead zoo animals or missing gangsters in there. And at least it's cooked. What a hamburger. I mean, it's. I was really shocked to read the Times, series of Times articles recently where they described during the recent E. coli outbreak for some cheap hamburger meat. It wasn't that the stuff that made people sick that terrified me. When they described how in the ordinary course of business, they make a lot of this meat and soak meat in ammonia, yeah, that shocked even me. And I'm not Eric Schlosser. I'm food safety is not really a concern, healthy eating not so much, but I do believe that you shouldn't be soaking my meat in cleaning products, and I also believe that as an American it's my right to order a burger medium rare. I don't think you should have to treat your burger like medical waste and cook it well done.
Does any other culture, any other country in the world, I mean, this is not your thing that it's all just about mass production and sort of industrialized production of food, but do any other countries have these expectations about their food production process?
I don't think the demand for as much meat on a daily basis, as much chicken exists anywhere else. Even in this country, it's quadrupled in the last few decades. And of course, that drives the market and creates a demand for cheap meat at any cost, no matter how it's raised, or cheap poultry. David Chang, the chef, said something very interesting recently about what the financial the collapse of a few years ago might mean to food and menus in the future. He said, we might be forced, as food prices rise, to concentrate on dishes where meat is used more as a flavoring agent, as they do in Asia, and less the main event. Now, that's going to be a tough sell in good times. In hard times, we might end up eating a little better.
Yeah. Anthony Bourdain, the new book is called Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook. I have to say, it's a great read. You're a really good writer, but your screed against the empire of mediocrity, about how mediocrity necessarily becomes the most profitable thing, was both right and very moving to me. So
thank you
for writing it and for being so pissed off all the time.
Thanks for that.
Really nice to meet you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I had a few little things to share with you because I got a lot of stuff that got piled up on me being gone so long. One of them is a blog of a coworker of mine, Scott, and his girlfriend, Christy. They took a month off. They traveled all over the place, all through Southeast Asia, including Vietnam.
and they blogged about it.
They took great pictures. They've got a lot of great stories to share. And so they're blogging about the trip. And the blog, it reads like a series of no reservations. The best stuff, too. So check it out. OrdinaryTraveler.travelerspoint.com. I'll put a link on the website. Live vicariously through them, okay? He's still going through the photos now. And there's already a ton of stuff up there, so I think this is going to go on for a while. I would love to be able to take a trip like this. I know at this stage of the game, probably not likely, but you never know. Anyway, the blog, it's going to continue to grow, obviously. And if you're interested in following two Americans through Southeast Asia, this blog will take you on that journey. Grab a bowl of noodles, maybe even some ramen, and then visit OrdinaryTraveler.TravelersPoint.com. I didn't get a chance to ask him if he shot any video. If he did, oh, that is going to be awesome. I'll ask him next week. Anyway, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. OrdinaryTraveler.TravelersPoint.com. Check the website. I'll put a link on there. Okay, so Top Chef Season 7, DC, debuts Wednesday, June 16th on Bravo. Looks interesting as usual. You never know how great it's going to be till it actually starts, right? The chefs have always looked like the regular group of misfits that you see every year. I mean, last year's group was incredible. So I doubt they're going to see anything like that. In fact, like I said this last year, you're never going to see a group like that again. That was nuts. The amount of talent. But you never know. You can only hope they're going to continue to outdo themselves. These promos that they cut are so lame. I think they're purposely lame just so you don't, you know, get an idea of who's who. Anyway, I got a list of the contestants. There's a bunch of them. Tracy Bloom, 33, from Shortsville, New York. She's the executive chef at Table 1280. Timothy Dean, 39, from Washington, D.C., chef owner of Prime Steakhouse. Tiffany Derry, 26, from Beaumont, Texas, executive chef at Go Fish Ocean Club. Tamisha Warren, who looks like she's got a real attitude. She's 24. She's from Christchurch, Barbados. She's the sous chef at the Oval Room in Washington. A bunch of people here. Amanda Baumgarten. Looks kind of smoking. 27, from L.A. She's the sous chef at Ford's Filling Station, which is a place that's been on our list of places to go. Alex Resnick, 33, from Brooklyn. Executive chef of Ivan Kanye's Cafe Vaz.
I should be your top chef because I can get things done in the kitchen.
I will be your top chef because I will crush the competition.
I've got the years and the experience.
I'm fabulous, and I make every meal an event.
My food has soul and swagger.
I'm a beast in the kitchen.
I'm the best of the bunch.
I can get it right when it counts.
I should be your top chef because I'm sexy and I can cook.
Top Chef DC premieres Wednesday, June 16th at its new time, 9, 8 Central.
Only by Bravo.
A quick thing here, not related to food directly, but kind of. I want to talk about it. I wanted to write about it, but it really pissed me off. I was going to write this long post about how we've forgotten our history, but I just couldn't find the time to sit down and write it. So I figured, no, what the hell, I'll just talk about it. As I said, one of the reasons why revisiting Oahu was important to me was because the last time we visited, my video camera malfunctioned the day before, and I was all, you know, I was unable to concentrate or get, you know, excited about going to Pearl Harbor because I couldn't get decent pictures, you know, of the Arizona Memorial. And it just kind of hacked the experience for me because I wasn't able to take it back with me and remember our time there and revisit it. And on the flight over, I wondered why it was so important for me to go back to Pearl Harbor. And I think it's because what happened on that day of the attack in 1941, you know, everyone, it changed America. We all know that. It thrust us into action. We defended our soil. We helped the UK defeat the Nazis. Basically helped us, you know, helped everyone save and restore much of Europe, particularly France. And as it deals with food, I can't imagine if we had not gotten involved, how far it had gotten. You know, to think about the changes in history, had we not helped win that war, would Julia Child have been able to spend that time in France, learn to cook French food, share that with us? Would we have El Bulli? Would we have the fat duck? Would we even have molecular gastronomy? Who knows what the general climate would be if we hadn't done our part in that war? But more than that, Pearl Harbor represents the men and women who lived in America at that time. Things were very different back then. The people of America were different back then, and Pearl Harbor kind of represents that era for me. Just as 9/11 has changed America, an attack on American soil, especially our military, is something as a country, we simply will not tolerate. But what irritates me is how newer generations think of World War II as ancient history, as something we really have no need to revisit. It's a been-here-done-that attitude. Whenever a new book or a new movie is made about that important piece of American history, simply it doesn't sit right with me when I hear these people talk this way. Because we really have not learned that much. The stories from the soldiers that fought that war, they all end with the same moral, that war is wrong and war is unnecessary. But you can't tell that to a nation of warmongers who don't go and fight war. The Arizona Memorial represents one single day in American history that lives in infamy, as Roosevelt said it would. It's a war that was important because it showed the will of America, the spirit of Americans back then. And I don't think we're made of that kind of grit and steel anymore. You know, to be frank, I think we've all gotten soft, like Pillsbury Doughboy soft. I mean, the events of 9/11, it brought out all these American flags, right? On September 1st, 2001, you'd be hard-pressed to even find a flag waving in front of a house on any given block in America. But on 9/12/2001, all you saw everywhere was a sea of red, white, and blue. It felt good to see that kind of patriotism, as if we were standing up and being proud of our country, something we, you know, had been lacking in recent years. But with that came a sector of the American public, of course, that believed that what took place in the World Trade Center and at the Pentagon was a hoax, like as if Michael Bay had been hired by the CIA to stage this whole thing. While I think 9/11 brought a greater sense of patriotism than most of us had carried prior to that happening, it didn't have the same effect on America that December 7th, 1941 did. It should have, but it didn't. And that is what kind of, you know, saddened me a little bit. But visiting Pearl Harbor in 2004 was a lot different than the visit we had last month. For one thing, the people who work there really don't seem to give a damn. I'll give you an example of what I mean. You basically, you get on a boat, okay? You as a group, you're in a certain group for a time. You get on this boat, and it's organized and it's driven by men and women of the Navy. And they take you, you know, across the bay to the memorial. It's about a 5-minute trip. In 2004, on the boat, they were very talkative, very attentive. And during the ride from the dock to the actual memorial, he told you a little of the history in case you missed it and gave you instructions how to get off the boat, not to stand and take pictures until you're fully inside of the memorial, and one very important rule. While you're on the memorial, remember there are over 1,000 men still entombed down there. Okay, so you're standing over a grave. So be respectful, and please don't talk. Don't run, don't yell, don't talk. And if you must talk, whisper. And in 2004, it was silent. It was almost unsettling how silent it was. All you heard were the waves crashing against the side of the monument, the wind blowing through. As you look down on the water, you see the sunken ship, you see fish swimming around it. You know, it's a natural reef now. The occasional drop of oil that comes from the top, you know, comes from the bottom, you know, disperses itself, because that ship is still leaking oil. But this time, it wasn't even close. They didn't tell people not to talk, so of course they did, freely. Kids were screaming, running around, hanging off the railings. People were talking out loud. Some people were talking on their cell phones. I swear, if you'd asked me if I was on the Arizona Memorial or waiting in line at Disneyland, I couldn't tell you the difference. That's how it was there. And I was frustrated, and I was a little pissed off, and I was sad. Especially considering that we were 1 week detached from Memorial Day, which is a day that was practically created for those men who died for their freedom, who laid entombed in that ship 200 feet right beneath their feet. And when our boat ride back to Pearl Harbor was over, the Navy personnel, who really didn't talk to us much at all during the entire trip, got off the boat. The guy was on a cell phone. Then they yelled for us to get off the boat and just looked away from us like they were bored. I don't want to sound like an old person, okay, but I think we need to remember to be more respectful, take pride in our country's history, maybe not exactly what we stand for now, but what we stood for then. Because the less respect we pay the men and women of that era, the less like them we become. And I think the less like them we become, the weaker we become as a whole.
Walking along the streets of Baltimore's lower-income neighborhoods, you quickly realize what's missing: grocery stores. Baltimore's brand new food policy director, Holly Freistadt, shows us the problem.
Yes, we are sitting in the middle of a food desert. A food desert being an area where there are no supermarkets or access to healthy food.
The options are scarce. Corner markets selling mostly processed food at high prices.
If you drove around this neighborhood, you'd see a lot of fast food.
Neighbors want to change that, and many came to this health fair at the local elementary school.
If you don't drive, you basically won't be able to eat.
It's a grim reality of how we have to live out here.
While grocery stores may be scarce, there are farmers markets within walking distance of some of these so-called food desert neighborhoods. The problem is some people on the food stamp program can't buy fresh fruits and vegetables here. Right now, if you come to the farmer's market, you got to have cash on hand. But in order to get low-income people to come and be able to use their food stamps, you need this particular machine.
Yes. So it's going to look and act like a debit card, okay. A debit machine, ATM machine.
So the first EBT machine, scheduled to arrive next month, is also expected to boost business for local vendors.
Well, if they start eating more healthy stuff, they won't be so fat.
Freistadt also wants to see more community gardens in the city and is working with local libraries where residents can pick up their groceries after ordering them online.
We can change the landscape of food.
She's changing it in a way that just so happens to fall in line with initiatives the White House has been pushing. She says Baltimore can be an example.
Let's say you and I are here a year from now.
Yes.
Okay? And we're walking through the Waverly Farmers Market. How do you want it to look different?
I would like to see everyone who wants to eat fruits and vegetables to be able to come here and to be able to buy the produce in the amount that they want and need to satisfy their food security at the household.
Bringing things like EBT machines into farmers markets is a first step. Baltimore health officials say the more challenging goal long term is going to be changing people's eating habits. Samantha Hayes, CNN, Baltimore.
I do have a couple more things to announce, and I'll let you guys go. I'm sorry for the length of the show here. This is what happens. I don't talk for a month. This is like my outlet. You guys are like my psychologist. Let me talk. I love that you guys not only dig the occasional cooking segments on the show, but the video. Video is definitely something I want to do more of, especially the street scene stuff. The feedback from the durian video, taco truck, and the bug video, great stuff. I mean, I appreciated it. But the cooking on the show was kind of a pain in the ass. Because I got to set up an entirely different setup of microphones. It takes a long time to put it all together. It's worth the trouble. Don't get me wrong. It's worth the trouble. It's just kind of a hassle. But what I plan on doing is going to kind of satisfy both sides of that. This summer, I am debuting on the web a cooking series. Just me, my video camera, and my kitchen. And the focus will be dude food. In fact, that's the name of it, dude food. My focus is to show you, step by step, just how easy it is to make all the things that guys like the most. Girls too, of course, but you know, girls, you tend not to need the help. You need less help anyway. So the series will focus on the simple needs of men. Things like chicken wings, homemade beer, bacon, beef jerky, ham, sausages like bratwurst, Italian sausage, summer sausage, potato skins, tons of stuff. First episode is going to be online soon. I can't wait to share it with you. I hope you find it educational. And entertaining, of course. Because listen, the minute I stop becoming entertaining is the minute this show becomes
shouldidrinkthat.com.
Hey, just kidding, dudes. Come on, you bastards. You know, guys, I love you. And one of the things I'm going to show you guys how to make in this series is bacon, of course. It's easy as hell to make bacon. Believe me. And once you learn, oh man, you're going to be hooked. I've talked about bacon a lot on the show, did a whole blog post on it. If you'd like to taste just how great my bacon is, I'm going to give you a chance. Joe from My Last Bite and I are teaming up for a dish at Eat My Blog Saturday, June 19th at Tender Greens in West Hollywood. It's going to be from 10 till 4. It's a huge bake sale featuring a virtual ton of food bloggers cooking up all their special dishes. Everybody from LA here. All proceeds of the sale benefit the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank. Go to eatmybloglawordpress.com for all the information, all the details you need. I'll put a link, a little banner on the website. Some of the bloggers will be there. People like my good friend Charles from 100 Miles, Kathy from Gastronomy Blog. I haven't even met her in person yet. Can't wait for that. And some actual chefs. Debbie Lee from Soul Town Tapas. I've talked about her to death. She's going to be there. She's making her bacon coffee cake with almond butterscotch drizzle. Hell yeah. Don't miss it. Come and say hello to Joe. Say hello to me. Taste Joe's delicious dish featuring my bacon. Okay? I think it might be a secret what she's making. I'm not going to tell you what she's making, but you'll certainly be able to taste my bacon. All right? Hell, I might even bring some beef jerky. All right? So we have a little snack. Maybe you can take a piece of that with you. Free with every purchase, something like that. I don't know if that's legal. I swear to God, I've never made this much bacon at once. I've got so much bacon curing right now. I know it. I'm going to screw this whole thing up. The pressure's on. Oh, boy. All right, listen. With that, I bid you adieu. That's some French. I'm sorry for the delay getting things ramped back up. It's all good now. We're good. We're back for another one. Special thanks to MSNBC, CNN, Travel Channel, and Bravo for the audio. Did I miss anybody? Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, if I did, you can sue me. Well, they probably will anyway. Music in this episode from Blue Stallion. Great song. If you like this song, you can buy it in the iTunes store from their official website, bluestolly.com. Visit mylifeasafoodie.com. I'll put links to everything. Great song. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie, and I'll see you next time. Yeah.